I am Dr. Dan Twelker. I'm host of Locals Only on 91.3 FM KXCI. And I'm here with Bird Baylor at her home. And we're going to talk a little bit about her work and her life. And it's so good to be here. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm glad you made it out the rough, rocky road.
It was just fine. There's a few rough spots right once you get off the main road. That I was glad to have plenty of clearance. But all in all, it's not so bad.
There are often cars that sit there for a week or so at a time waiting for somebody to take them away because they couldn't make it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's why we all drive trucks out here.
Yeah. I find so much, I do have something with four-wheel drive, although I very rarely have to use it, but it's nice having the clearance.
Oh, yeah.
Is there, maybe a bunch of waters come through and exposed rocks or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Uh-huh. And I see you have a truck, too.
I have a truck, yes, yeah. Of course. And since I just got this truck, not that it's a new truck, but my old truck burned a sad, horrible death. And then I got this truck, finally. And I came back and realized that I didn't have any bumper stickers on it.
I noticed your bumper stickers right away.
So last night, somebody brought me, one of the No More Deaths people, Steve, brought me, or he just happened to have them in his truck, about 50 bumper stickers that were all pretty good, and so I got them, so now I feel better.
Let me look through my bag here, because I did bring you a couple gifts.
Oh.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because here's
a KXCI bumper sticker. That's fine. All right, that'll go. There's just space for it.
Yeah. We also have another one that it is about local music, but I didn't happen to bring that one. But that's the main KXCI bumper sticker.
That's good. Yeah. There's only one more I really have to have. I feel like the kind of the ultimate universal one is Question Authority, and I don't have that, but I have a lot of other good ones, and this is just fine. I'll put this on.
Great. So do you question authority?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I don't think there's any other way to live. But of course, out here we have the Border Patrol. We can question every day. But
and I should mention that we're out near Aravaca, south of Tucson, a little bit west of Tucson. Not far. It's an hour drive or so to Aravaca from Tucson.
Yeah, but then another half hour out here over the last 6 miles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is. It's nice and wild and beautiful. Right now, because of all the mesquites being leafed out, you can't really see as much out in the hills and see really where we are. I can't even see across the arroyo right now, and I have a huge arroyo here. But I like someplace like this, you kind of notice every seasonal change, I think, more than being in the city, or I do. I mean, because there's so much. And this is pretty remote. It seems remote to people, and yet it's not, half an hour to get into the little town of Aravaca, and another hour or so to get into Tucson, depending on that you're driving.
One thing I like to do with radio is to describe the setting that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind describing where we are?
Well, there are wonderful mountains all around, and my arroyo, which is called Papalote, is huge and wonderful all year. Of course, when we get the rains next month, it will be roaring. Just occasionally, just absolutely roaring. And when we first moved out here, when I first moved out here, maybe 20-something years ago, it often ran for weeks at a time, actually running. One summer, even a month at a time. Right now, we're lucky if it runs for a couple of days. But it's beautiful to see when it happens. And of course, this is more high desert land, and and I love low desert too. I have to go around the desert out from Tucson, but it's getting farther and farther to get to it from Tucson. But there's some things out there that I miss and need to go and see. This, we don't have saguaros. We have some ocotillos, but lots of beautiful wildflowers if we get any rain.
And how about your home here?
Well, it's my home is handmade for sure. Two or three people in around Tucson who knew what they were doing gave us advice and came out and worked some, but mostly it was done by people who just felt like we could do it. And so it's adobe, and so we've laid adobe, and all the doors and windows, everything like that, came from Gerson's demolition. So 25 years ago, they were already beat up, and they're a little more beat up now. Some are falling off, but I like all of them. And then we added on the house part, which is just one big open room with a loft. And my so-called office is lower, a couple of feet lower than the loft over that. And everything, it was kind of a nice concept, and I love the feeling, since it's not a huge space, of having everything left open. But on the other hand, I think it would be kind of nice sometimes to have a room you could close the door and nobody'd know how messy it was. But I still like it like this. And then we added porches and a little rock archway porch where I sleep outside in the summer. And then I had a place for a lot of plants, and I love to sit down there or walk down there. Sometimes I've slept down there too. And then my shower has a wood-burning hot water heater, and it's all glass, so if you're looking out over mountains and you can be showering and watch the deer walk up and down the wash. I had deer drinking out of my fish pond yesterday and the day before, and javelinas come up for water. So it's just kind of comfortable, and I have a composting indoor outhouse, which isn't real fancy, but it works. It's just fine for me. And I sleep outside a lot in the summer, and that's one of the best parts of it. And just being able to wake up under the stars. And I just wonder why people in Tucson don't at least sleep in their backyards, because it's something that's so wonderful. You just almost hate to go in the house on a summer night. So it's not, how I live isn't unusual though for people who live out and around here. We all do pretty much the same thing. Yeah. But I do have, I leave my doors open a lot, and you know, I guess it's probably a flaw, but I just love everything being open. So I prop all the doors open, and the reality is that, of course, in the summer when it's cooler in here, snakes like to come in, and you very often have rattlesnakes that I get to recognize. I know them so well, and they like the damp cement and flagstone down by the shower, and they were all coming in. A lot of them came in that the door into my greenhouse, because it's one that's open all the time and convenient for snakes. But a man who's, well, he's a friend of mine now. I didn't know him before. Benji Sanders, who's a photographer at the Star. He realized that I couldn't keep the snakes out if I wanted to, because there is the door, what do you call the bottom of the door jamb or something. It didn't come down to the floor, and it was just exactly the size for snakes to go under. So he came out to take some photographs and ended up down on his hands and knees working with a saw that didn't even have a handle on it, fixing my door. So now if I close that, I know that nothing will come in. And sometimes I do close it. But you just live in a kind of, this isn't actually the greatest way to be a writer.
It is not?
No, because there's too much going on. I mean, you're going to sit there at your typewriter when javelinas are walking down the wash or something, or people. And then the other thing is I have a lot of migrants who come by, and I might be in the middle of writing, and there are two or three hungry, tired, exhausted people who need food, water, maybe medical care, standing at my gate. I guess you're going to quit writing. And that happens quite often. And on the other hand, I wish now that years ago when people first started crossing the border so much to look for work and were in such bad shape, and I wish then that all the people who had been here, say, in a 6 months or even three months period, it would have been a wonderful book if I had gone to the villages or the cities that they came from, to their families in Mexico, and farther south sometimes too, and visited them and seen their lives, and then seen exactly why this man and their family left home. Not out of pleasure for himself. And a lot of times these people told me that a village might, some of the small, especially the little Indian villages of south of Mexico City, they would select the two or three young men that they thought had the most skills in building or whatever it was to go to the U.S. so they could send money home. And but I would love to have gone to, say, if I did 10 people who came, and here are their villages, and all. But so anyway, I'm a slow thinker, and I didn't think of what a good book it would be until later.
Well, here you live out well away from Tucson and even away from the smaller town of Aravaca, and yet you say that you're quite busy observing and interacting with the people that come by, and observing and interacting with the animals that come by, the deer and the javelina and the snakes. And
there are lots of things, you know. I used to think that maybe, you know, if a writer could just sit in a closed room, maybe looking out from 10 floors up or something, and probably get more done. But on the other hand, all the things I write about are the things I do, and the land particularly. So it's good. When I lived in Tucson, do you know that little area of Las Lomas, little rock houses way out West Speedway? I used to have, when I first came out here, I kept one of those for another year or two. Like I said, I loved writing there too, as you have all these things around that are great to, when you get a break, to go out and walk, but it still isn't the tension of knowing that there are migrants around that you might need to help. But yeah, wherever I've lived, I've always been outdoors a lot, and I like to write outdoors too.
Let's talk about your personal history. I read that you graduated from the University of Arizona.
I didn't graduate.
Or that you attended.
I tried to graduate.
You tried to graduate. You attended the University of Arizona.
Yeah,
what years would that be?
I have no idea. I have no concept of years or math, and I usually call somebody and ask them. Bonnie Henry knows, because mm-hmm. she looks things up and figured it out and mm-hmm. all that, but I don't know. But I know that when I went to the university, I knew, I'd always known since I was a little child, I knew I wanted to be a writer. That's all I was going to be. And so I didn't think I needed to study anything that didn't relate directly to that. And while I thought that all kinds of interesting things like philosophy or various subjects that would be fine. I never took any kind of math or science ed, and I actually can't do any math, which I mean I have all the math I'm truly capable of doing is something that relates to from 1 to 10, and I'm really good at that, but that's it. And so you know, you kind of make up ways to compensate for things you're lacking. But anyway, I did have a wonderful time at university because I dropped any class I didn't want to take, and I took lots of literature classes, some writing. I didn't do as many classes in actual writing as I did just of writers, poets. So the things that the humanities. So I enjoyed that, but I got married when I was a junior, and I did had some correspondence classes that I took up, went to live in San Francisco, and but I missed the desert, and I could hardly stand the fog and cold, and know that it's not where I should live, however wonderful it is. I'm limited in the places that I can feel at home. And
so you wanted to be a writer, and you were a writer, and you took some classes, and uh-huh. And then
I worked on the Citizen too for I don't know how many years, but that was my first job. I loved writing for the Citizen. I wasn't good. I was a terrible newspaper writer, actually, because I wanted to polish it up. But you don't do that. You write fast, and it's supposed to be good to begin with. But I did that. They let me write a lot of feature stories, and they let me cover. I think they let me cover art shows. Quite a few things there, and that was fun. I loved doing that, but I didn't. I had studied some journalism at the U too, just in case I didn't make $1 million my first year of writing. No, I never really expected to make a whole lot of money. I just wanted to write the things I wanted to write. But I wasn't able, either at the university or in anywhere else later, to let anyone give me very many suggestions about writing. And in other parts of my life, I'm not just incredibly rigid, but I knew what I wanted, and I might not have gotten it perfect, but I always know exactly the feeling I want, and I just didn't want suggestions. So that's kind of crazy when you're a student at the university not to want to listen to a professor's suggestions on how to make a story better, but I didn't. But and then later on, when I came back from San Francisco, I worked at the Citizen, and that was fun for me. And when they found out what kind of things I could do, which wasn't general reporting, they let me go and do some other things, and then I enjoyed that. I could write other kinds of features and things. But so I've always, and when I was a little kid, when I was about 12 years old, I was sending out poems to magazines, but I wanted them to think it was an adult, so I'd write, after the poem where you put your name, I would write Bird Baylor, age 36, and, which I thought was the ultimate age for a poet, you know. And then my mother told me that was very unprofessional, that, you know, if they're going to buy it, they should buy it because it was good, not because I was 36. And, but it's kind of nice to know from childhood what you want to do, and I know myself when I'm happy with something I do or not. I don't really need anybody to tell me. I mean, I like it when people like what I've done, and there's certainly, you know, of course, all writers do. We want somebody to read what we do, but I'm also happy if I write something that I never even show to anybody, if I like it myself.
At what point did you start writing books, perhaps intended for children?
I think it was. I was living in, I think the first one, and I could be wrong about this one. I think the first one I wrote when I was living in Virginia. I was married to a man who was Stuart Udall's administrative assistant, so it was Washington D.C. But the Udalls lived across the river in Virginia, and we lived there too. And so I had time that I wasn't really doing anything, and I was working on, except writing, which is hard. But I was working on a book at that time, and the first book that I sold was there, the first kid's book. It was, it's Amigo. It's about a boy who's taming a prairie dog, and the prairie dog's taming him. And so that was the first one. And then I just kept on doing it. But everything I write is really set in Sonoran Desert. And a few things might have more of a... I only think of one, but a couple of them might have the kind of country in mind of South Texas, where I was before my family came to Arizona, and the Rio Grande Valley kind of place. So, which was all open, also a farm. But I like being where it's open, and I feel better with lots of space. So everything I wrote was real. And I think that children, too, and I think I think like a kid, but one of the things that reaches us emotionally is nature, and at a very early age, and high emotion. And so, of course, if that's something that children read about, they relate to it in a powerful way. If that's what you're giving them, is a feeling about that. So, I'd like to think that if I like it a lot, probably somebody else will. And if I don't like it, nobody else ever has a chance to see it. So,
And you've written many, many books now.
I've written a lot of books, and I don't know how many. Sometimes I think I have friends who know how many, but I don't know. But there's maybe 25, or, you know, I told you about this math deficiency. I can't even count the books, but I think probably 25 or 6 or 27, something like that. And and some of them, a lot of them have, I don't know how many of them, I'm sure some are out of print, but there are a lot of them that are in print. Yeah. And I think that just right now, not that I don't plan to write other kids' books, but right now I'm writing some essays for adults, and really for me, I'm an adult. I've done those for a long time. I did some years ago for City Magazine when Chuck Bowden was an editor there, and it started out that Chuck said, all my friends have to give me a piece of writing. And then so, and I'm sure we all did. And then he said, some of my friends have to give me one every month. So I did that for a while. And So I wrote a lot of essays then, and then I'm doing other ones now, and it's I don't know, it's really nice kind of thing to write, kind of casual. Well, everything writes casual, so I don't know, but it's you can write about whatever you want to, and I haven't done any on the. I would never write about an issue like migration issue, border issues, but I write about individual people that I know who are in the middle of that horrible stress. And I probably will do a few of those just on some of the people. But there are a lot of other ones that are kind of lighthearted and like... give you a typical title. One of them is called Good Women Who Love Bad Trucks. And there are a lot of things like that. And out here, of course, if you write something like that, which I did for our paper, everybody in town knows exactly which truck you're talking about and who it was that found it, left it on a hill with a note saying you hated it and fixed it for you. I was hoping somebody would drive it to Mexico, but somebody repaired it. But anyway, so I just take whatever little happening in my life and write something about it. And so we'll see.
I really enjoyed reading the essay that you wrote here for your local paper, The Connection.
Oh, The Connection, yeah. I write for The Connection all the time now. And you're looking at is one about seasons, and that in Arizona or right in the desert, we don't have four seasons. We have hundreds and hundreds of seasons and talk about them. And I do write for this paper, and which is fine too. Not only I'm writing something for, in Aravaca, everybody, it's such a little, close community that you kind of have to do that. And but then this gives me a chance to I get nagged to write a new one, and then that will be eventually enough to do the book of essays. In fact, if I write the two or three other ones that I want to do about migrants who've come through, I probably would have enough. So, and then I'm fairly disorganized, but I have to find them all. And of course, I write on a typewriter. And just recently, one of the nicest gifts, I've been complaining because it's so hard to find typewriter ribbons. I have a friend who's living in Portland, and there's a shop there that repairs old cameras and old typewriters, and so I have three manual typewriters, so every time she gets on a plane to Portland, she takes one of these heavy old typewriters and then brings it back worked on, but they weren't selling ribbons, they were just repairing typewriters. So this woman who came by, one of the Samaritan patrol who is out leaving water for migrants, came by, and somebody from New Hampshire or someplace was visiting, and she was looking at my typewriter, and I mentioned the typewriter problem. Anyway, I just got a letter from her, a little package yesterday from New Hampshire with four nice new typewriter ribbons in it. So that's fine. But I really don't like the sound, the noise of computers. I don't like any kind of noise like that. Whereas a typewriter that doesn't make a sound until you hit a button sounds good to me. So I might as well be happy in my work. Right? I mean, that's a good excuse for using a typewriter. But anyway, I'm such a slow writer that it's just bizarre for me to have something that one of the reasons the people would like it is that you can write fast on it. I mean, like a computer, I don't need to. I could chip it with a flint as fast as I write.
So when you write, do you tend to edit it later or to sometimes toss out sections?
No, I edit as I go along, page by page, sometimes quarter of a page by quarter of a page, but I don't like to leave anything around that isn't, I mean, I don't like to even leave a page that I don't like. And a lot of people, this is one of the reasons that I think you need to teach yourself to write rather than to take a class on it, because everyone knows how to rewrite and how to look at a finished, you know, something that they've just done 20 pages or something and decide what to do to change it, to make it better or whatever they do. I don't do that. I can't stand, I couldn't write a page and leave it there that I wasn't happy with. So I might write a page that I wasn't happy with, but I'd go over it right then and try to fix it. And if I couldn't, I'd pace around and curse and cry and walk in the wash. No, not quite that bad, but you know, but I know when I'm happy with something, that's all. And nobody else probably would even notice that it was either good or bad. But to me, I'd notice right away.
So you have the typewriting on the paper. Do you go back and with your hand?
Yeah, and a lot of times I use a lot of yellow pads too. Sometimes before I type, I write on a yellow pad. And those are handy to have around in your truck or wherever you are. And sometimes, you know, you'll just be hung up over a line or a couple of words, and you don't really want to go ahead and type it until something's better in your mind. And so I'm a very slow writer is one reason probably that I write such short things. That way I can do that. If I, you know, I did one novel, which is Yes is Better Than No, and it's about the autumn on the reservation. And the people I wrote about were friends of mine, and I really had a good time writing that. And I did change it around a little bit and had maybe changed some sequences, but I just had kind of interwoven lives of different people out on the south side of Tucson who I admired very much as people. And I had actually been, I had been hired as, I was supposed to counsel people. And I have never been very good at counseling even myself. So there's very little chance I'd be good at counseling other people. But it was more like a friend that I'd sit and drink coffee and we'd talk and talk about what their problems were. And these were people who were having their electricity turned off and having the horror of living in public housing where you're not supposed to have a man living with you, and just all kinds of regulations. And, you know, the more you accept, the more regulations come with it. So, and then I also knew their extended families out on the reservation. And then people would know that I was going around on the south side helping Indians. And then some Mexican family would come to ask me something, and I could hardly say, well, sorry, I'm supposed to, my job is for Indians, so I would be helping them too. And I was pretty overwhelmed with work. It's supposed to be a part-time job, but I had so many people. I mean, obviously, there's... but what I did, it would be very nice for these people, and it would be highly needed any time. to have someone who didn't represent any state agency just sitting down with you to drink coffee and sort of talk over what your possibilities were. And so that's what I did pretty much. And while it took a lot of my time, and I was actually only being paid for a half-time job, and I was working all the time, and people were calling me at night. But I used a lot of that information in the book of Yes is Better Than No. And I still know some of the people that I met at that time, mostly in South Tucson, but back and forth to the reservation. And I really admired a lot of the people that I met then too. I admired how what their goals were and how they lived and what they got by on and how little hostility they really held toward the general public administration of justice, which isn't great. But the other books really relate to either my own experiences, my way of feeling about land and animals, whatever's around me.
Rocks
for sure. Yeah.
Well, you have the one book, remind me of the title, but it has rocks.
Everybody needs a rock.
Everybody needs a rock.
Yeah. that's the book that bought my last truck for me, the one that burned, because it was just a funny thing that the Cheerios, whatever company it is, I've forgotten who makes it, General Mills or somebody like that. They had five writers, and I was one, because they took one of the books, and it was Everybody Needs a Rock, shrunk it down to maybe, I don't know, 5x7 or less, and did it in black and white. And though this book was already in black and white, and kind of put it under heavy clear plastic in the outside of the Cheerio box. So everybody who buys a massive Cheerio box for 3 months or something gets this book. And so for that, they had a million of them. I wasn't sure at first that they were going to pay, because they kept talking about how what a wonderful thing they were doing for children, giving them a book. It sounded like they considered themselves really marvelous, but actually they did pay for it, and that's how I got that truck. I took the money the day the check came. So people out here call it my Cheerios truck, but the Cheerios truck burned the other day. So, but it was very nice. But yeah, that was a very short little book that did give you 10 rules on how to find a good rock. And I'm somebody who generally doesn't go for rules much, so they're pretty loose rules.
And how about your book, When Clay Sings?
When Clay Sings. Like, it's kind of a tribute to the wonderful Native American potters who in all the, for generations have been making, and even prehistoric pottery that's so incredibly beautiful out of the soil, beautiful clay. So that's the clay of that one. So there's just, and there's a lot of them I write about animals, and I'd hardly ever write anything that doesn't at least have a mention of a coyote in it. But so I did another one about coyotes and Desert Voices. It's talking about I don't know how many creatures are in it, desert creatures, but everyone speaks for himself in there. So that's a first person from coyotes, snakes, tortoises, all kinds of things, and then the desert person also. And I've made it clear that to my mind, we're all equal sharers of the desert person and the desert tortoise or anybody else. And so that one was kind of everything I write is just really the nice thing about being a writer. And for this kind of thing, you write exactly what you believe and say what you think is important to you, even if it isn't important to anybody else. But so it's kind of a, I mean, nobody tells you what to write. An editor could make a suggestion, but I don't think they ever have to me. I mean, they have to me on one book, the book called The Table Where Rich People Sit. It's showing the riches that you have without actual money riches, but they felt that the girl's family were much too hippie like. The publisher felt they were too hippies, tippy like, and that the girl was thought for herself too much and was pushy, and they didn't like a lot about that. They wanted me to change quite a few things, and of course I didn't change anything. And they said that they felt that the book had, and our children need to know that you work hard to get ahead. and here we're talking about just enjoying nature and where you live, and obviously not having a job that's going to bring a lot of money. And so they said, they wrote to me and said that they had discussed with the artist, Peter Parnell, and that they all thought that the people were pretty much without values, and they thought that it needed to make some changes because we need for kids to know that you have to work hard to get ahead. And so I said, I'm not changing anything. And eventually it didn't. And luckily, there have been a lot of people without values who bought the book over the years. It sold very well. So I think, but if they hadn't wanted to buy it, I would have just had to not sell it, but I wouldn't have changed it. But that would have been no story if I had changed it to what they wanted.
It seems to me, in writing for children, I don't even know how to ask the question, but how do you know what to say? How do you know how to approach it and that children will be able to relate to your language and your words and all that?
It's an interesting question, but I've never really written down to children. I feel like I probably use simple language just naturally, and that's about as far as it goes. I think, and then it's been kind of interesting that a couple of things, and I'm not sure which one right now. Oh, I know, one is called The Way to Start a Day. And of course, I love sunrise, so I'm doing that moment, the one moment of sunrise. I had expected to write a book on all the wonderful mythology of sun, just sun anywhere. But it turned out, after I got it finished, because I never made an outline, I kind of forgot my plan, that I just wrote about the moment of sunrise all over the world in different cultures. And a lot of different schools had parents complain about the book. And because my thought is probably that the reason that happened was that I had given equal importance to any culture in the world. I think some people thought I had forgotten to mention one person said, one letter of complaint was that I had failed to mention Christianity. But then, you know, it's not, Christianity's never been really big on sunrise ceremonies. On my Easter Sunday, maybe people go to church but early, but that's not what I call really welcoming the sun. So I didn't feel I needed to do that. And it wasn't meant to be about religion. It was meant to be about cultures and how people actually, I mean, the magnificent stories of people, you know, all parts of the world going out and greeting the morning. So that one had a few people who actually didn't like it. But it was one of my favorite ones. But what I was going to say, we're asking about, I don't know, that's one that came out in an adult magazine as an adult poem before it was a children's book. I think it was in Red Book or something like that. There's several that that there's really no difference in whether, and I think it's because I write very simply, and it. And the concept is simple, so it doesn't matter who reads them. But there was another one. I'm sure that also came out first in a magazine as for adults. Oh, and as a child, I memorized poetry constantly, I didn't make to my mind. I memorized what I know now was adult poetry and some that was written for kids. And a lot of it was the sound of the words and just the general feeling of it. So I think a lot of times if you're writing is just normally as simple as mine is, it'll go for kids just as well.
I love the... again, this is the essay piece that you wrote in The Connection, June 2009. Of course, what day is today? The 12th? 13th?
I think it is, or 13th.
Today is the 13th, I think. Yeah, June 13th. So that we're right in June, so this is recent. And you're talking about the four seasons and about how folks back east were saying, oh, it's too bad that you don't have four seasons.
Yeah.
And then you start to write about all the different seasons that we have here in the desert, in the high desert, Sonoran Desert.
Yeah, I was thinking about that a long time ago because people said that. I was visiting Peter Parnell, who's the artist who did most of my books, and he lives in Maine. And I'd gone to, we were talking at some university together, and I don't remember exactly where, but it must have been close to Maine because we went over there where he lives, and everybody there, and it was fall, and everybody was talking about how in the desert, you know, you don't have the four seasons, and I was just appalled that they only had four.
What were some of the seasons that you wrote about? Some of the seasons that we are able to enjoy in the Sonoran Desert.
Well, let me see this. I'll read you the first couple of lines of it if I could. Because it does, and there's so many that I can't even read them all to you, but they would say they could never give up having four seasons, and I would say four, that's all you have, only four. I tried to explain that we have 20 or 30, depending on depth of personal observation as well as personal whim. I mean, some people notice the difference in the color of a saguaro thorn from rainy season when it's white to dry season when it's brown. And they favor white saguaro thorn season for the way it makes the sun shine through them like so many halos. Some people notice that in December and January, coyotes howl in a different voice from summer coyotes. It's lonelier, sadder, crazier. Now that I think of it, I'm lonelier, sadder, crazier in those months too. It has to do with winter darkness and the sun not rising as early as coyotes and desert rats know it should rise. Anyway, I ask a few desert rat friends to name important desert seasons. Everybody's list included green corn tamale season as a late summer ritual, celebrating the blessings of corn as well as green corn tamale cooks, and perhaps also as a movable feast. Some people mentioned the force of the heat in late June. As desert people all know, it is entirely different from heat in late July. To lump them together as summer would be an insult to heat. June is that particular kind of heat which has a physical touch. You feel it pressed against you, a solid being, as real as a hand against your face. I remember getting off a plane at the Tucson airport in late June and feeling that touch and throwing my arms around the June air, feeling suddenly fine to be home again. So June gets its own June heat season. In my family, mesquite leafing out season was always one of the big ones. Most desert plants occasionally make a mistake and put out leaves too soon, only to be damaged by one last surprise frost. Not mesquite, though. When it leaves out, it will not freeze again. So there's quite a ritual of sighting those first tender leaves. When my father was 87, he said that only twice in his life had he seen mesquite make a mistake, and that's more than you can say for most of us, hence the importance of mesquite leafing out season. But anyway, all those dozens and dozens of seasons, I did have a good time.
And then you talk about the monsoon.
And the monsoons, of course, which is everybody's really favorite terrifying season. And living right here, this arroyo can just absolutely roar, and all kinds of things go whirling down at, you know, just big, big trees and pieces of lumber and cars and whatever is out there. And it's interesting, too, to see, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, because my grandson, Jesse, as a kid, of course, had spent half his time walking in the arroyo down here. And he was recalling that it's changed its shape depending on the force of the water season after season, because it moves the sand along. So the wall moves back, and it does change a lot. So it's really nice to, it's one of the kinds of things that's nice about having, being close enough to an arroyo, that you really notice from year to year what it's done, because it doesn't, for sure doesn't stay the same. Another one of the good things about living here is that when I walk up the hill, I have a great view of Baba Kivri, speaking of the reservation, and it's kind of nice to have that. And, you know, and it's not that bad to think that you need to walk up a hill, because it's a nice thing to do about sunset time anyway, and just to get a view of it.
Baba Kivri is considered a sacred mountain.
It is a sacred mountain, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's also part of the creation story, I believe.
Yeah, well, it is, for the autumn, because Itoy, who's made the world, lives up there and still is up there. And I did a book on that, too. I did a book on sacred mountains, a little kid book, and I really had a good time doing that. And another one that's kind of fun to do is I went around to Indian reservations in Arizona only, and had kids in grade schools. We talked a lot about first to get ready to do it, but kids, and a lot of these were Indian boarding schools. Some of them were just, well, every tribe. The kids could write what's their own favorite story from their tribe. And of course, a lot of times when they're doing the all night storytelling and more traditional ceremonial stories, they'll tell stories that kids like to keep the kids awake, and they do stay awake. And so those are a lot of the kinds of stories they'd write. But I wanted them to be sure that I wanted to be sure for myself that they didn't write any stories that they're not supposed to be handing out to some visiting Anglo. And so we'd just talk about it, and then I would tell them to choose what they thought was just the best story from their tribe that they'd like to share with other kids who didn't know it. But they would have to write it, and then they'd take it home and see if their parents think that's a good one to do, or their family, their grandmother or somebody. And so they did that. And the teachers all enjoyed it, doing it in the Indian schools, because it's writing something that the kids could really get into enjoying working on. And so it turned out to be a really great little collection. And there are all the sacred mountains and a lot of wonderful Apache stories. And that was years ago. But individual stories keep being, because they all have the name of the writer and the school and the age of the kid. They're reprinted all the time. So, of course, that's fun for those kids who are grown up now, but they saw that's what they were writing when they were little. But I do like mountains, sacred mountains, and I love Baba Kivri. And I like a few others too, but that's just the one that I've seen for so many years, and really I feel, you know, a story like that. The University of Oklahoma asked me to come and do the same thing in Oklahoma, or I don't know if the university, some place did. And I said I really couldn't, because I don't know the Oklahoma stories. I mean, I knew all these, and I'm the one that has to know them to be sure, you know, what I'm getting. And just for instance, when I was over in Yuma and doing this, and a kid in second or third, fourth grade wrote a story, and I said, well, that's really interesting, because the Pimas have a story like that. So he shrugs his shoulders and says, well, so I'm Pima. I just happen to be out here. Well, if I didn't know that and I was going around the Oklahoma tribes, you know, I would know that somebody else had a story just like that. So I wasn't able to do it, because I like to know what I'm doing. But that's a dear little book that I didn't write myself, except I wrote introductions to all the different sections so you'd see what it is. But they do have some good stories. Relating mostly to animals and landmarks, things like that.
I found out about your work through the story that Bonnie Henry did in the Arizona Daily Star not that long ago.
That's right. That was recent, yeah.
Yeah. And someone had cut out, in fact, it was the entire article, and they had taped it to the window of Antigone Books on 4th Avenue in Tucson. And I was walking by and I saw that. And they referred to you as the Desert Druid.
Well, that's because I do have one of the essays is called True Confessions of a Desert Druid. And it's one that they like. There's some organizations in town. One of them is, I don't know what they call it, but it's from some St. Michael's Episcopal Church, where they have a really wonderful Guatemalan project every year of going. They're nurses and maybe doctors too, nurses and doctors, and they take medical supplies, just simple things like vaccinations, and to this little village somewhere in Guatemala. They have to walk up a trail for 8 hours, no road up there. But anyway, they have a big send-off every year to the group and to help raise money to do it. And And for the last 6 years, they've invited me to come and read there at their send-off. And I always do. And one of the, and I read from kids' books, and then I usually read an essay or something. And one of them was True Confessions of a Desert Druid, which, of course, the Antigone's people had heard, because they always come to help and to sell books and help this this event. But yeah, and that one is it will certainly be in the, I think True Confessions of Desert Druid probably be the title of the essay collection. But that one, the thing I was writing about was that when I was at Kenan Tucson at some time, I went to St. Joseph's Academy, which was a Catholic school for girls and out on Wilmot, which then was the far east side of Tucson. Wasn't the middle of town like it is now. And at that time, I went there. I went there because my parents thought it was a good school, or my mother did. She chose the schools. And so I wasn't, if you go to a Catholic school and you're not Catholic, you're called a non-Catholic. And so that's what I was, and that was fine. But one morning at assembly, this is all in the essay, one morning at assembly, Sister Marietta, the head of the school, said, "Girls, I have an announcement to make. I want you to know that there is a pantheist among us." And so we all look at each other, and we don't know, well, what's that? And then she said, so she holds up a piece of school paper, lined paper that we're writing on. And she said, does anyone, can anyone give me the meaning of pantheist? Nobody could. No, we had no idea. And so she said, now the pantheist who wrote this does not need to identify herself, but I'll read it to you. So she starts reading, and of course, I'm the one that writes this flowery kind of prose that everybody knows it's mine. But I hadn't known the word pantheist, but I had written about kind of my emotional connection to a mesquite thicket. And I had ended this essay with the words, "This is my desert, this is my God." And so it was wonderful. And as I said in the essay, the essay starts by saying, when I was 11, I found out I was a pantheist, and it came as quite a surprise, because up to then I'd always thought I was a Presbyterian. And so this is Father Fowler's favorite one of my essays. But anyway, it turned out that when I found out what a pantheist was, and that I was famous in that school, I was the only kid who was a pantheist, and all right. And the girls even were interested in looking at what I brought in my lunchbox, because I brought different food from theirs. I brought things like maybe avocados or artichokes or something. nothing they ate. So I had a great time with it. But in order to answer all their questions, I had to go to our ancient religion section of our library and study all the ancient religions and find out. And I finally, a couple of months later, I converted to Druidism, and I wrote another essay on why I was a Druid. And Sister Marietta never read it in assembly. She was out sick of this, and she never brought up the new vocabulary or anything. But I had a really good time. So Anyway, that's why I was going to did this one, the True Confessions of a Desert Druid, which I think we'll have for the title. it was really taken. I mean, I'm sure the nuns didn't take it seriously, but the girls did. And since I, especially then when I changed and I kept handing in essays on being a Druid, and they wouldn't read them. Sorry, you can see this whole essay book is going to be just lots of different kinds of things, but local type things.
I am Dr. Dan Twelker. This is 91.3 FM, KXCI, Tucson. And I'm here in the home of Bird Baylor. And we're talking about your books, your life, about nature, about pantheism, and being a desert druid, and having a great time. And thank you so much for inviting me here.
Oh, I'm so glad you came out today.